So for our final presentation, we're going to be hearing about the 2012 report to Congress on the prevention and reduction of underage drinking and the implications for public health. And substituting for Stephen Wing are two people. One is John Park, who is a senior public health analyst with SAMHSA's CSAP, Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, and he's the project officer for the new data collection, analysis, and reporting contract, and the cross-site evaluation of the Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant Program. And also presenting for this last time, for the last presentation, is Jim Mosier again. This time he's representing he's here as a contractor for SAMHSA and the CDM group, and he's helped putting together the STOP Act report. And he's still, as he said for his bio, he's still a public health attorney with 30 years of experience. And we'll have a couple minutes at the end for questions. Thank you.
I'm going to be really quick. The reason why I'm here is because this is about the federal law, and our policy is to have a federal presence to such presentations. And Steve was going to be here, due to the severe restrictions in travel, some of us could make it and some of us couldn't, so I'm subbing in for Steve. But real quickly, I'm just going to introduce the STOP Act, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Mosher, and he will describe the report. Just use this button? Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay. Okay. No conflict of interest. I'm going to briefly describe what the STOP Act is. It stands for Sober Truth on Preventing Underage Drinking Act. It was enacted in 2006, and there are four key components to the law. The first one is we have to have a federal coordination and reporting, the ICPUT was born. It stands for Interagency Coordinating Council for Prevention of Underage Drinking. Through this body, now there are about 15 federal agencies, you know, DOD and Department of Education and such, and SAMHSA is a lead agency, and that's why we are here. The federal coordination included the annual report to the Congress and the state report that Jim is going to be talking about. Second leg of the four-legged stool is a national media campaign. And the third leg is the intervention programs. Many of you probably know already the drug-free communities programs. That's funded through the ONDCP, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, right? Okay. The DFC is that program. There's also a program through a higher education grant. The fourth leg is the research on the patterns of underage drinking and the scope of problems, youth exposure to alcohol advertising, and other media messages. Just briefly review the funding, the history of the STOP Act, I think the slide is pretty self-explanatory, unless you have questions about them. And then what I'll do is I'll turn it over to Jim to be talking about the report to the Congress and the first state report.
Thank you, John. So I'm back, this time as a SAMHSA contractor. And again, it's really, I appreciate you all being here. This is something we've been working on with SAMHSA for 3 years. I'm very excited about it. Unfortunately, when we signed up to come to APHA, we thought the 2012 report would be released by now. It is in clearance. and hasn't come out yet, and we don't expect it'll come out until after the election. And you can draw your own conclusions about why that's so. Anyway, so we do have the 2011 report I'm going to describe. The 2011 report is available. The data is kind of out of date. We're going to get this new report out any day, and it has the. It will be available at the same place. I think I have the slide. Go to www.stopalcoholabuse.gov, and it has. It's greatly expanded in terms of the amount of information we have from each state. So I'm just going to briefly let you know what's going to be in that report. The kind of resource I think it can be for your work at state and local level. So in terms of, I'm just going to skip this and get right to the state report because we have limited time. The whole document, the report to Congress, really the state report is chapter four, but it's like its own volume because it's hundreds of pages long. We have an overview of the problem, a review of the research on the nature and extent of underage drinking. Chapter 3 is what each federal agency is doing. We're going to talk about Chapter 4, report the policy summaries and state reports that we provide for each state. Here are the topics that are included for each state, the state underage drinking prevention policies. I think we're up to 22 discrete policies. What the enforcement agencies report about enforcing those policies, which obviously overlaps with what Kath reported, their survey. We've coordinated the two surveys. And programs, what states doing in terms of programs targeting youth, parents, and caregivers. I'm going to spend less time on that third leg of this. And the state survey, there's two data collections that we engage in. First is an actual state survey. We send it out to all 50 states and District of Columbia. And that's where we got the data on their enforcement practices and what programs they have in place. And we got a 50-state return. And then we conduct independent legal research. Many of these policies come right out of the Alcohol Policy Information System that is funded by NIAAA. Then we do original legal research on additional policies that augment what we have in APHIS. State and local enforcement activities, we look at the strategies states are engaged in, compliance checks, cops and shops, shoulder taps, etc. And then we ask how many they've conducted, what the violation rates are, and the number of minors in possession violations. We also look at the extent to which they report local versus state. We were going to be showing you the actual results of the surveys. We don't have that data available, as I said, because it's still in clearance. And then we look at sanctions. This has all been, these data were all collected based on what Congress said they wanted in the STOP Act itself. The programs, we get descriptions of the programs, how many youth, parents, and caregivers are served, whether there's an evaluation. Whether there's interagency collaboration within the state, and what measures are to reduce youth exposure to alcohol advertising. And then we also get state expenditure data. We'll be reporting on how much money they spend that's separate from their federal block grants and federal pass-throughs, and what the source of those fundings are, including taxes, fines, and fees. Okay. So that's all the rest of the report. I'm going to spend the rest of my time now looking at the part that I'm really excited about, which is the policies, because I think this is really a contribution to the field that can be a huge asset working at your local level. So what we've done is we've divided the policies into four discrete categories, and we have so the first category is laws addressing minors in possession. This is all out of the APHIS system. If you're interested in any of these policies, just go to www.apis.niaaa.nih or Google APHIS. It's possession, consumption, internal possession, purchase, and false ID policies. The second area is underage drinking and driving, youth BAC limits, use-lose laws, graduated driver's licenses. The third area is laws that target adult suppliers. That's furnishing, RBS, a responsible beverage service, minimum age for serving alcohol, dram shop and social host liability, party host laws, direct shipment laws, and keg registration. Then we have 6 additional policies in the new report. Those were all in the original report, and now in the new one, we add 6 more. 3 of them that the STOP Act included in their mandate: compliance checks, protocols, penalty guidelines, and home delivery. And then 3 policies that the House Appropriations Committee recommended SAMHSA include in their appropriations report: alcohol taxes, drink specials, and wholesaler pricing. Now, for each of those policies, we first do a policy summary. So there's 21 discrete policy summaries in the report. And that's where you can find out a background of what this what the policy is, how we came up with the variables and what they are in terms of what we report, what the summary of all the provisions are, how many states fall into which categories. We have maps that show what the state variation is. And when we have trend data, which is mostly the APIS policies, we show what the trends have been in that policy. I'm going to do one policy summary to give you an example. This is what the state report looks like. I picked Pennsylvania randomly. For each state, we first have a summary, a state profile of drinking facts. That's all from the NHTSA survey, data from actually from CDC and NHTSA, just describing what's going on in the state for easy reference. And then each policy, we have what that law is for your state. So you go through, I don't have all the policies here, but you can see we report the different variables. I'm not going to get into the details here. I just wanted to get you a sense of what you'll get when you pull out your state report for 20, I think it is 21 policies. Here's what we've done. So let's just look at one policy as an example, party host laws. And for party host laws, what they mean, and this is described in the policy summary, establish state-imposed liability against an individual social host responsible for underage drinking events and property they own, lease, or otherwise control. So we describe the policy. Here are the variables that we report. What are the evidentiary requirements, the types of property included in the law? Does it include just residences? Is it outside areas, outside buildings? What affirmative defenses are available to the host? Some states will let the host off if the host calls the police, if they make some effort to stop the party once they become aware of it. And then what states have general versus specific laws? This is the kind, when you get into the weeds on this stuff, this is the kind of thing you find. Many states have passed new social host laws in the last 5 years. But when we did the research, we found laws that have been in the books for 30 years that included, that when you read them carefully, it included social hosts. It said it's illegal to provide alcohol or to allow any person underage to consume alcohol on premises you control. It's right in the furnishing law. But if you ask the law enforcement folks or the public health people in that state, they'll say we don't have a party host law because they don't have one that is uniquely addressing it. It's buried in the furnishing law. It's just as good as an enforcement tool as the new ones that are being passed now. So we found many, many states that already have the law that people didn't know they had. So this is the kind of thing you'll be able to find when you go in the state report, and it can be news to policymakers within your state and law enforcement officials. I had this experience recently. We were working in North Carolina. Actually, it wasn't on this law. It was on state preemption laws, in which I found out through work that Ryan actually did some of the work on this. In North Carolina, there's a law that says that we thought North Carolina is a total preemption state. Localities can't do anything. And that's true at the initial licensing phase. But after the state issues the license, every year the licensee has to go back and get permission, basically get a permit from the local government in order to continue an operation. So, in fact, localities have a huge lever with the outlets. You better be in good stead with your local government and local police, because after 1 year of operation, the localities get to say, you're closing down. So we found this out. We put it into a report. No one had told us this, who had been working with in North Carolina. Ended up talking to a former judge who's working with the prevention group that had hired us, and I was talking to the judge about it, and he didn't know about the law. And he's been very active in dealing with alcohol outlet density in the state. So these are the kinds of things we're looking for and trying to highlight in the state report. Here's the map. This gives you a sample of the kinds of maps that we'll have available that gives you a snapshot of what's going on around the country. As you can see, the blue states are the ones that have the general hosting laws that, in many cases, the state aren't aware that they have it. And you can see we still have a large number of yellow states, which are states that still don't have a party host law. And here are the trend data. This is from APHIS, so we do have trend data. And there has been in the last 20 years, for these types of laws, believe it or not, this is major increases in the number of states. The laws tend to move like molasses in this area. So having several states enact new laws in the last 5 years is a significant trend from a legal standpoint. I added this map. This is a map that we're putting into the new report. It's not on APHIS, which shows the standard of care. The speaker who spoke first talked about the importance of evidentiary standards. Well, it's the same issue in this law. Where there's a huge difference among the states that's hidden, and again, you'll be able to find this in the state report, is the extent to which the prosecutor has to prove that the host knew what the heck was going on. In New Hampshire, as an example, they're a state that requires the host to have actually engaged in what's called an overt act. Now, what is an overt act? Well, maybe buying the alcohol and bringing it in, but not furnishing it, or, you know, putting out flyers, maybe. Hey, there's an underage drinking party at my house. So it really limits the possibilities of prosecution. Kansas has got a reckless standard. I talked about that, or the first speaker talked about that. There's also the knowledge standard, and then what we'd recommend, again, the negligence standard, which is relatively rare across the states. Okay, so that gives you just a snapshot of what's in these reports. Again, stopalcoholabusenow.gov is where you're going to find it. And we'll have it up on the web in a way that you can just download particular policy summaries or particular state reports, or you can get the whole thing. It's a massive document, but I think you're going to find it a really useful tool that we'll be updating every year. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for your really fantastic presentations. And we have about 10 minutes for questions. So feel free to address questions to specific speakers. And I just ask the speakers, if a question is asked of you, if you could come up and repeat the question to the microphone for those who are accessing this over the web. So go ahead.
Policymakers change some of what's happening. Really good question.
I'll try to summarize the question, which is, yes, the evidentiary standard is important, but what about penalties? If the penalties aren't severe enough, even if you lower the evidentiary standards, they're still not going to be likely to comply because the punishment is unlikely. And, you know, that's basic deterrent theory, which is it's an interaction between the perception of likelihood of being caught and the likelihood of a penalty being actually imposed. There's also the third variable, which is the swiftness of the penalty. In the case of the sales to intoxicated persons specifically, and there's some parallels to underage drinking, furnishing, in fact, the penalties can be quite severe. What's on the books very often, and most, we did this in 2007, we didn't replicate in 2011, but in 2007, what we found was many states say, one violation, you can have your license revoked, or you can have it suspended, or you can have a $1,000 fine, but it's discretionary. It's up to that. So, and it's similar actually in the furnishing to minors or possession to minors. The legislatures are very happy to go, oh, well, we'll jack the penalty up, but they make it really, in essence, discretionary with the agency. And the agency doesn't do anything about it. They don't enforce it. They don't, so there's no threat of a penalty. So what New Mexico did was the agency, this was not a statutory change, it was an agency change. They established protocols for how they were going to administer that penalty, where they said three strikes in a year and you lose your license. That's what California did with sales to minors. I think it's the protocols that are more important than the penalty in the statute, because the protocols is what the message is to the outlet. The penalties don't have to be real severe. They have to be severe enough to hurt them monetarily. That's right, in order for the deterrent theory to work. But we need those penalty guidelines in conjunction with evidentiary standards that are feasible by the agency. And you do those two together, you're right, you do those two together, you're going to get action. That's what we've done essentially with compliance checks for sales to minors. We need a parallel thing to happen with sales to intoxicated persons.
Did you still have a question I missed you earlier? Okay. So the question was, how can other communities kind of do this work if they're not familiar with it or don't have know of someone that can do it? We were talking about this before the session, how easily it is to do some of the GIS work now with tools like Google Earth. I mean, there's stuff that's available that's open source that you can, like, take the stuff that I've done and easily transfer it into Google Earth, which means it can be disseminated to multiple people and many people. I would suggest, if you don't know of somebody that does GIS, almost every college, university has got a geography department or other people. If it's something that's related to crime data, they might have a criminal justice. There's people that are dispersed that use GIS. And a lot of these colleges and universities, I'll speak for myself, the people there are looking to do projects. And this is a great opportunity to collaborate with the colleges and universities and communities, other organizations and agencies. I'm not going to push any particular software, but there are grants available, especially for nonprofit organizations, to take advantage of getting the software, because it is costly. The software that I use costs about $1,500. So if you want to get around that, though, almost every, well, I know, like on campus, a lot of universities have a campus-wide license that you can go to the library and you can use the software for free. So there are opportunities, and I would say just contact a university. And even if it's not in your location, someplace, you know, I can do studies in other places. I don't have to just do Kent. gentlemen.
I've got a question also about your mapping study. There are a couple of interesting things in it. One is there's a lot of interaction between, it looks like, young men and the outlets, which you would expect in a college. That leads into a kind of broader question of whether you're looking at a systemic situation. Lots of young men, lots of outlets, lots of activity going on, or whether there are a few outlets that really stand out. And whether you've got, like David, we've done work like that, we've used police data, we have found it's almost, I think, an iron law now, that something like 5 to 7% of the outlets will contribute to like 50-60% of police activity. So there's a interesting interaction there between what the whole system looks like, what exactly you're doing. And then the next question that follows that is how do you use that information to work with city officials to get better oversight for the outlets, particularly when colleges and universities are really, by and large, very reluctant to take on local jurisdictions on these issues.
Okay. So for the first question, addressing, are there certain bars or outlets that are kind of causing most of the problems? I would say that that is definitely where we're going with the next step, with looking at kind of more of a smaller scale analysis. Even at smaller than the neighborhood level, you can even go to like a street corner or just around that outlet. So that's kind of where we're headed, to try to identify that very thing, especially if we look at this closing of what were considered nuisance bars. You know, are they really nuisance bars? And so we're going to use calls for service data, which is going to give us an idea of the calls coming in around related to these locations. Now, using that information to work with city officials, I haven't gone there yet. So if you have any suggestions, I would love to hear them, because I think that's the logical next step. That's definitely where you need to go. And I can understand the political issues of working with university.
That actually is very parallel to what Jim was talking about. It's one thing to be able to look at the phenomenon, to have the basic control system in place. It's an entirely different thing about how that policy gets implemented in a place that is sensitive to health and safety issues.
Right. I agree. Thank you.
Okay, unfortunately we're out of time, but I want to thank our presenters. Your presentations were amazing. And of course, feel very free to come up and talk with people directly. And thank you very much for attending.